friend Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, crippled and increasingly out of touch with the paper now, and Mose's relationship with Orville Dreyfus friendly but not nearly as close, her scrupulousness hurt now, as an incident in 1961 revealed. A review of Lewis Mumford's latest book referred to Moses as an example of city planners whose concentration on highways was destroying needed open space around cities. Mrs. Sulzberger wrote a letter to the editor of the book review, taking exception to that sentence and noting that, "I have worked very closely with Mr. Moses for almost 30 years, and I would like to testify that he has never considered a roadway merely as a means of transportation, but he has always made them into parkways, using every bit of acreage possible for parks and playgrounds." But the significant point about the letter was not that Mrs. Sulzberger wrote it, but that writing it, a mild letter at that, was all she had done. Similar criticism of Moses would soon be running in the Times again, in book reviews and in the paper's news sections. With the accession to the publishership of Arthur Oakes' Punch Sulzberger in 1963, such remarks increased in number. Moses would complain to poor old Sulzberger on his sickbed, and Sulzberger would call in Punch, and the editors closed ranks, and they started looking for other things to prove that Moses was not worthy of the praise overall, Shapiro says. Most important, the editorial page editor of the Times was no longer Charlie Mertz of One Gracie Square and the Morning Rides Downtown, but John Oakes. Even while Dreyfus was publisher, Oakes had been attacking Moses' emphasis on highways at the expense of mass transit and parks. After the publisher's death on May 25, 1963, Oakes went further than he ever had before, spelling out the paper's change of heart in an editorial on Moses' 1963 push for the lower and mid-Manhattan expressways. As a newspaper, we have previously endorsed those crosstown expressways, and we stand by that earlier endorsement. But we must admit to a growing disenchantment with great urban highway and expressway schemes. Particularly irritating to Moses was the new refusal of the Times to print every letter he wrote it. "That really infuriated him," Ingraham recalls. "He really thought everything he wrote should be printed." But there was a powerful predisposition in the press toward a favorable, cooperative attitude toward the fair, a predisposition based greatly on financial considerations. Most of the New York papers were desperate for revenue. It would not be long after the fair's close that the Herald Tribune, World Telegram, and Journal American died, and the fair was a source of substantial revenue, both through special fair supplements crammed with advertising from fair exhibitors and contractors, and through increased advertising aimed at fair-bound tourists by hotels and restaurants. There was, moreover, civic pride. The press was part of the city's establishment. In the circles in which the publishers moved, the New York World's Fair was not an event to be derided. And a fair was a fair. "There was nothing to be against," as Joe Kahn says. "What was there to be against? Did you ever hear of a fair or a circus that people were against?" No editor or publisher wanted to be the one to cast the first knock. All Moses had to do was ignore or roll with the criticism of his other activities, and as the fair began to dominate headlines and editorials, that criticism would fade before a tide of praise. The honeymoon may have been over, but a divorce was by no means inevitable, particularly on the grounds of a World's Fair. But Moses made it inevitable. He did not ignore the press or roll with its punches. He did not forgive it. Rationally, logically, he knew that, for a public figure, fighting the media is a battle he can only lose. He was, in fact, constantly expounding this axiom to his aides. But it had long since ceased to be reason or logic that dictated his actions. It was emotions, feelings, passion, the complex, fierce personality to which, for decades, he had become accustomed to giving free rein. That personality made it impossible for him to ignore criticism. During 1961 and 1962, he was embroiled in battle on several non-fair fronts: Henry Barnes, the Fire Island Road, the Lower Manhattan Expressway. press coverage was noticeably restrained, editorial criticism rather light. But no matter how glancing the attack, Moses seemed impelled to retaliate massively, by public attack on the paper involved and the press as a whole, and by private complaint to editors about reporters and to publishers about editors. And his attitude carried over to the fair. He scheduled press conferences because he realized intellectually that the fair needed the publicity, and because, rationally, he felt sure he could charm the reporters into friendliness. But when he found himself in the same room with these men and women who had attacked him, reason fled before rage. He went out of his way to show his contempt for them. The face he turned on them was one of disdain. His answers were sarcasm and scorn. He lectured them, and he antagonized them. It would have been easy to make them allies. He made them enemies instead. Any real chance of a reconciliation vanished on August 5, 1962, when he began lecturing the press in public as well as private. The first lecture might, according to Sid Shapiro's post-mortem analysis of why the Times' Old Line Sunday editor decided to sponsor it, have been called the Lester Markle lecture to show Mrs. Sulzberger that she was making a mistake in allowing new editors to be brought in. For whatever reason, Markle invited Moses to write an article for his Sunday magazine, giving his views of the press. Moses accepted. The power of the press, radio, and television to make or break any man in public life is awesome and often grossly unfair, he wrote. The press, for the ostensible purpose of keeping it honest, has done much to make public employment dangerous and unattractive. Many a good official has been frightened or flattered by idle gossip, random criticism, or attack. Aaron and Hur do not hold up his arms so that his side may gain the victory. There is a type, fortunately rare, which is indifferent to the ordinary decencies and proprieties, skilled in eavesdropping, glued to keyholes, willing to embarrass families and friends, a species to whom nothing is sacred. Such reporters, if they could, would wire and violate the confessional. I sometimes wish we had a few Gorguses to keep yellow journalists off our necks so that we would be free to do our work. Perceptive journalists sense that the public is tired of hearing Aristides called the just, and therefore yell for his ostracism. There is a notable tendency in the press to cut officials to one size in a sort of bed of Procrustes, to put on spiked shoes and cleats and to jump on victims when they are down, like a mob at the fights shouting with such glee when an aging champion is beaten up and dethroned. There is also a potent minority of jackals and vultures who hang around the outskirts and hover over trouble spots to discover a wound or blood and then close in or swoop down for the kill. Cleverly and dramatically reflecting public opinion is one thing. Planting suspicion, poisoning minds, rousing the mob spirit, quoting out of context, these are cute tricks, far removed from straight, honest reporting. Critics build nothing. The only excuse for a critic is to toughen the hides of his victims. Jackals, vultures, yellow journalists. There is only one way to get the press united, and that is to attack it, Joe Kahn says. Now, Moses had attacked it. The reporters who had to cover the fair every day, the reporters he had insulted at first to their editors, then to their publishers, then to their faces, then to the public, were now his enemies. If he gave them material with which to tear him down now, they would use it for all it was worth. And he gave it to them by lying. He had been twisting facts for years, shielded by the secrecy which the courts had erected around his public authorities. But the World's Fair was a private corporation whose records were open, one, moreover, which was, because of its need for public support, forced to operate in the public eye. The press could look at the World's Fair, and he made it willing and determined to look. Joe Kahn looked first. Moses was deluging city desks with fair brochures and progress reports. The Post reporter began to read them with care. I don't like to say it was a natural antagonism against the man and the men around him, he says, but I guess it was. And it was natural, being the kind of reporter I am, to be suspicious, particularly when you have these suspicious characters around, guys like Rosenman. I mean, he was the lawyer for all these guys who tried to fuck everyone. You had to be suspicious when you saw he was involved. And you know, you started reading those brochures, and you could see he, Moses, had the same old crew in. Khan began to look for tie-ins and conflicts of interest and that kind of thing. And soon he was telling Post readers about the $10 million a year restaurant business that Moses had handed to two fair directors for a pittance rental without competitive bidding, and was feeding Stan Opatowski, writing a series titled Who Do You Have to Know? Or How to Do Business with the City, information about the lucrative arrangements with Deegan and Donahue and Pruce and Constable and Spargo and Shanahan and Rosenman. From Moses' public relations offices was coming a steady stream of announcements of states, foreign countries, and prestigious private exhibitors who had agreed to sponsor pavilions. Khan began to check into those announcements. I couldn't call Panama, for Christ's sake. The Post would have gone out of its mind. So what I did was I called the embassies here, and I wrote to every governor whose state was supposed to be in. I was never assigned to the World's Fair. Nobody in his right mind would assign me to a thing like this. It took too much time. So I was doing it all on my own, at the same time that I was doing my regular assignments. I was doing it all myself. God, I remember now. I never told anyone what I was doing. A terrible, awful job. But it began to produce results. Moses had announced a huge hall of medicine and health to be sponsored by the American Museum of Health. When Khan telephoned the museum's chairman, he said the museum had decided not to sponsor the exhibit. Moses had said that California was sponsoring an exhibit. Khan checked, and Governor Pat Brown said California was not. Soon there were other stories. Puerto Rico drops out of 64 Fair. Virgin Islands drops plan for pavilion. The city's other papers were reluctant to pick up this new theme at first. As late as the spring of 1963, the general play given to the World's Fair in New York's press was still upbeat. But Moses took care of that. The first of a new series of press conferences on the fair's progress was held on June 27, 1963. The prepared statement with which Moses opened it had evidently started out to be a plea for cooperation. We are not shrinking violets or sensitive plants, and constructive questions won't irritate us, he said. Let's be working partners in bringing the world to New York. But it turned into a statement with the Moses touch. We at the fair build. The press, in its many manifestations, reports. Who am I to explain our respective missions and to acknowledge our dependence upon you? We are entitled to the support of all decent citizens. Error is the besetting sin of journalism, perhaps occasionally acknowledged in the confessional, but almost never publicly. The reporters found, moreover, that their questions were not considered constructive. He had planned the main news of the day to be the fact that ground was being broken for a Sudanese pavilion and the fact that the fair was coming along on schedule. Do not, we ask, overemphasize the absentees, he had said in his statement. The reporters persisted in asking about the empty spaces on the map behind him and how much missing rental they represented. He began to get angry. The reporters asked him about the fees paid to Pruce. That is not a subject that comes under the category of the fair's progress, Moses said. The reporters walked out fuming, and the Herald Tribune's lead the next day was that the fair's economic prospects were trimmed yesterday. Its article enumerated every unoccupied plot. The Sudanese pavilion barely made the last paragraph. To attack, there was for Robert Moses only one response: counterattack. A few days later, a group of Queens civic leaders were touring the fair. Greeting them, Moses noticed reporters nearby. This is a highly critical community, he rasped. I think we have more critics than we are entitled to for our size. They foul the city's nest and are always more interested in what is going wrong than in what is going right. A luncheon that had been planned to clear the air with the new editors who were taking over the places once held by his friends at the Times did little to convince them of his reasonableness. Public officials lunching with Times editors almost invariably do so at the Times. Even presidents come to them. Not Moses. If they wanted to see him, he told Ingraham, who was arranging the luncheon, they would have to come to him. They agreed to do so, and eight or nine. The very top, Daniel and Salisbury, were there, recalls Ingraham, journeyed out to Flushing Meadows one day. Ingraham says he was brought along to explain things to them, but explanations were to prove superfluous. Moses made things perfectly clear. Moses started sounding off and made some reference to his job as city construction coordinator and the power it gave him, Ingraham says. So Frank Adams, Times city editor, asked, "How far does your jurisdiction as construction coordinator extend? The way you put it, it would seem that if a road starts in Florida, you have jurisdiction over it as long as it ends up here." "I consider that an insulting question," Moses said. Leaping out of his seat, he stalked out of the room, leaving nine top executives of the New York Times absolutely flabbergasted. For a while they sat there, stunned, waiting for their host to return. Gradually they began to realize that he wasn't going to. Says Ingraham, "After a while, we just got up and went home." Moses paid the price for the pleasure of giving his emotions rein. In every announcement, the press found something to carp at. When the administration building opened, they emphasized not that the first structure for the fair had been completed, but that it had cost $1 million instead of the expected $600,000. When landscaping on the site began, they noted that it began well after the promised spring of 62. Did Moses proudly announce that the city had agreed to construct a $3,500,000 science museum? A far cry from the multi-million-dollar federal science pavilion erected by the United States at the Seattle Fair. Press conferences were the stage for the most overt encounters, of course. At every press conference, there would be mounted behind Moses a huge map of the fair. He wanted to talk about the exhibits that had filled in spaces since the last press conference, the new exhibits that had been signed up. They insisted on asking him about the spaces that remained empty. Why was the fair having so much difficulty persuading states and nations to exhibit? He would get angry and blast the press for making an issue out of something he considered unimportant. The blast would be the biggest news of the day. He couldn't let anything alone. He had to fight with everybody, and fight publicly. Negotiations with H.L. Hunt, the eccentric Texas oil magnate who had offered to rent 152,000 square feet and erect a complex of thrill rides and the other amusement attractions the fair so badly needed, together with several restaurants, were probably doomed from the start, since Hunt was as accustomed as Moses to having his own way. But since the negotiations had never been a matter of press interest, their termination did not have to make the front page of the New York Times. Moses put it there, after disagreements over the standards of the rides, which Moses felt might be too gaudy, had reached the point where Moses ordered Hunt's check for more than $1 million returned, with a full-scale statement to the press that arrangements had been mutually terminated. Hunt, who had previously been happy to go quietly, felt called upon to make his own 8-page statement, denying that there would have been any gaudiness and that there had been anything mutual at all about the termination, saying that he would have been happy to be part of the fair despite Moses' vacillating and capricious moods and emotionally arrived at decisions, until Moses had flatly declared he was out. All of which not only increased the air of controversy around the fair, but emphasized the difficulty Moses was having in providing traditional amusements for the fair. Moses wanted a $25 million federal pavilion at the fair. but his reaction in public statements, press releases, and testimony before congressional committees was one of such outrage that anyone, even a United States senator, should raise any questions at all about a Robert Moses demand that Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois called him one of the most competent and irritating men in the history of the United States. Before Moses arrived in Washington, the request, with President Kennedy solidly behind it, had been regarded as assured of passage. By the time Moses left, it was all but dead, and only White House intervention saved it in scaled-down dimensions. Not satisfied with what he had thus wrought, Moses proceeded to make new public attacks on congressional stinginess. In a dozen such incidents, Moses created controversy where none was necessary, handing reporters fuel he had made them anxious to use. And when they used it, turning it into stories, he attacked them for using it, thereby making more stories. It was attack and counterattack and attack and counterattack in a war of words that escalated and escalated and escalated again. As opening day grew closer, the fair, thanks to its president, was surrounded by furor. There was the racial controversy. There was, of course, not a single Negro or Puerto Rican on the fair's 200-person administrative staff, and not many more even in menial posts around the fair administration building, until Scrivain managed to ease some in, and the protests of Negro civil rights groups were met by Moses with scant courtesy. And there was the religious controversy. Every one of the major religions in America was represented at the fair, save one, and Jewish leaders were increasingly perturbed by the absence of any representation of their faith, some of them seeming to feel that the fair was not especially anxious to have any. Their feelings were not especially assuaged by the fact that when Israel decided it could not afford a national pavilion, after learning that the cost of its pavilion was more likely to be $3 million than the $1,250,000 Moses had promised, Moses attacked Premier David Ben-Gurion. There was the controversy over unions. The press dubbed it the Great Garbage Controversy. Foreign exhibitors were shocked by $17 an hour per man garbage collector rates. After enraged Spanish pavilion officials refused to hire Allied maintenance crews and tried to hire their own, Teamsters refused to pick up the pavilion's garbage, and the Spaniards threatened to dump it into the Unisphere pool. And then the controversy over art. Moses turned down repeated requests by artists' societies for a pavilion to display American art because no one came up with the high rental he demanded. Then there was the opening on time controversy. Instead of simply admitting that a few exhibits and some landscaping would not be ready on opening day, which would have made this a not very newsworthy item, Moses kept insisting, although he knew differently, that everything would, which allowed the press to do daily stories on the items which were behind schedule. Moses was raging at the press now. If these jackals and hyenas thought they could attack with impunity, he'd show them how wrong they were. Blasting the assorted dyspeptics, grouches, grumblers, hit-and-run writers, and talkers who hint broadly that our fair will be artless, boycotted, funless, foodless, constipated, strangled, and tasteless, he told 1,400 members of the Fifth Avenue Association gathered to honor him in October 1963, that he had decided that, if your natural weapon is the broad axe, you should not affect the rapier. And, dropping the more delicate weapon, he swung the axe more and more frequently. By the start of 1964, it seemed that every speech, on whatever occasion, the opening of a new pavilion, the dedication of the Unisphere, welcoming a delegation of New England governors to the fair, was an occasion for a vicious denunciation of the news media. Some of the controversies he won and some he lost, but all had the same result: more publicity about strife and disunity at an event whose slogan was Peace Through Understanding. He had turned a skirmish with the press into a full-scale war, and he had been its leading casualty. Out of the Flushing Meadows, an expanse of flat, barren, almost unadorned land not 2 years before, there took shape now a square mile of forms out of the past, like the thatched replicas of African tribal huts housing treehouse restaurants, of forms out of the future, like the hulking massiveness of the United States Pavilion, and of traditional fairground adornments, such as the curving, looming dark walls of the Hall of Science, the little brightly colored cable cars swinging in procession overhead, and the clusters of white balloons that marked the brass rail hot dog stands scattered throughout the grounds. A flag-lined, fountained scene that may have been disorganized and hodgepodge, but that was also somehow vital and vivid. Not trend-setting, certainly, but gay and alive. A scene certainly not boring. A scene that may not have titillated the sophisticated taste of New York intelligentsia, but that would have thrilled the general public. But in the public perception of the fair, the perception created by the media, this scene was not foreground, but background. There loomed before it the figure of its creator, dominating the scene, muting its gaiety, casting a dark shadow across its brightness. A figure not inviting, but hostile, a figure of arrogance and controversy and rage. With the opening, on time, of the fair, the wind of controversy died away for a while, but the whirlwind was still for the reaping. The first hint of the great storm to come was the daily attendance figures. Every day that the fair was open, its expenses were $300,000, on top of the $30 million it had spent prior to opening day. To pay these expenses, and to fulfill his promise to the city to repay its $24 million loan, and to have the necessary $29 million left over for his great chain of parks, the daily attendance had to average 220,000. Moses had confidently predicted it would. There would, he boasted, be many quarter-million days. But the controversies he had spawned had come home to roost. Attendance on opening day, April 22, 1964, was 49,642. Moses ascribed that to overdramatization of the civil rights protest auto stall-in and to chill, drizzly weather. But attendance the next day, clear and warm, was 88,130. On the first weekend, there were crowds each day of 170,000. But during the following week, the fatal figures read 45,000, 53,000, 38,000. Wait until May, when the weather turns warm, Moses said. During the entire month of May, there was not a day on which attendance reached the break-even 220,000. On only 7 days did it reach 200,000. On 5 days, it did not even reach 100,000. Attendance for June was scarcely higher. Wait until July, when the schools let out and parents can bring their kids, Moses said. All through July, the fair waited, in fair weather, for its first quarter-million day. It never came. On only 5 days did attendance reach 200,000. By the end of July, according to Moses' conservative forecasts, 25 million persons should have paid their way into the fair. The actual number was 15 million. With attendance thus off by 40%, so was revenue from admissions and parking fees, and from the fair's percentage of concessions and restaurant income. The fair was not earning the profit Moses had expected. It was not earning enough even to pay its bills. It took Moses a long time to realize the implications of those attendance figures, partly because for a long time no one told him about them. His shrewd money men, Spargo and Madigan, were not part of the team handling the fair's day-by-day financial administration. That team had been brought over from Triborough. Its head, Irwin Witt, the fair's comptroller, had been Triborough's comptroller. Controlling for Triborough had been a notably undemanding job. The monopoly enjoyed by the authority made its revenues easily predictable and inevitably increasing. During Witt's years as comptroller, the authority had never once been in serious financial straits. The extravagance and wastefulness of its spending, extravagance not only condoned but encouraged by its chairman, had bred within the authority an attitude toward money of carelessness and disregard. And it showed. At the fair, Witt had made a mistake worthy of a first-year accounting student. he had credited all the advance discount sales to the first year's income, thereby making the fair's balance sheet look far better than it should, for the balance sheet did not reflect a fact that would become apparent during the second season, that 15 million persons who would be attending during the second season would not be paying to do so. Had attendance been as high as predicted, there would have been so much money that the mistake would not have been fatal. But it was fatal now. The money had been spent, and no more was coming in. And after Moses' aides finally did realize the implications of the attendance figures, they still took a long time to tell R.M. about them. For they were afraid to tell him. Knowing the blind, punishing rages, and in some cases the ostracism, the severance from power and prestige and money with which R.M. greeted bad news, not only Witt, but the executives to whom Witt reported, the constables and Shapiro's, stalled for weeks before breaking the news. The only one of Moses' aides with enough guts and money to tell the boss the unpleasant truths was George Spargo, then chairman of the Fair's Finance Committee. Spargo had been working for Moses for 30 years and was closer to Moses than any other aide. Unlike the other Moses men, he was close to the boss personally as well as professionally. They double-dated together. Spargo had introduced him to the woman who was to become his second wife. By any standard, including the one that, in the Triborough Empire, really mattered, the money that Moses had let him make, Spargo was Moses' favorite. When Spargo told Moses the truth about the fair's finances, Moses fired him on the spot. "We don't want any negative thinking around here," he said in an explanatory memo to the staff. Then he summoned Witt to his office. The comptroller was a short, mild-mannered, white-haired man of 65 with a history of heart trouble, whose wife had recently died. His session with Moses lasted for almost 3 hours, and he returned from it pale and trembling. "He was never the same again," one of his secretaries says. "Within days he had suffered a heart attack, from which he never recuperated. He underwent open-heart surgery, did not recover from it, and died." When, sometime in late August or early September, it appears from his memos, Moses at last began to realize the seriousness of the situation, it was too late to remedy it. The money had been spent, $30 million before the fair opened, and perhaps $30 million more since April 22nd, a total of perhaps $60 million. He had expected the fair to have earned $90 million by this point. It had earned perhaps $35 million. He had been able to spend the extra money because he had also had in the till about $25 million worth of tickets sold but not used. But because these would be used during the fair's second season, income during that season would be very small. There would be very little new money coming in, and so much had already gone out. Frantically, he tried to cut back expenses, but what could he cut? The contracts with the insurance companies, with Deegan and the engineering firms, were already signed and had to be paid by the month. So did the annuity contracts. Interest on the notes was mounting daily. He took some measures, issuing a memo, perhaps the first of its kind ever sent out of Robert Moses' office, ordering a drastically reduced budget for maintenance and security, and an effort to reduce expenses in all areas. The Allied and Pinkerton forces were cut back to levels at which they should have been all along, about half of what they had been. But other areas resisted economy. As Peter Brennan puts it, "The unions had been built up to this high level. They resisted cutbacks." And the economies were, simply, too late. He had paid out $60 million. He couldn't get it back. Attempting to conceal the truth from the press, Moses' aides consistently inflated daily attendance figures. A special, handsomely, expensively printed interim report announced that the fair had been a financial success, and as of August 31st had a balance of $12,700,000 cash on hand. But when he tried to sneak an $8,600,000 appropriation through the Board of Estimate, Mary Perot Nichols of the Village Voice spotted it and began to speculate publicly that the fair might be in financial difficulties. Following her lead, other reporters spotted other clues, although the conclusion drawn was only that the fair was not making as much money as Moses had predicted. No one, all through 1964, guessed the truth in its full extent. Moses appears not to have known its full extent himself. Certainly his aides, having seen what happened to Spargo and Witt, were not going out of their way to tell him about it. "You've got to remember," says one city official, "that everyone out there was scared to death. Moses made all those people, and he can destroy them. He doesn't want to hear that his fair is going badly. He's always regarded criticism, however constructive or well-meant, as a personal attack. All he wants to hear is, 'Yes, R.M.' The result was that his own people allowed him to live for months in a fool's paradise." It had to end, however. The fair was not a public authority. When its money ran out, there would be no legislative appropriation to put more in its till. When its money ran out, it would be out of money. There was going to have to be a day of reckoning. It came in December. The bank presidents, who, with Spargo gone, made up the fair's finance committee, had become increasingly worried over the vague rumors they were hearing and over Moses' evasions when they asked for hard facts and figures, and he had finally agreed to appoint an outside auditor. The expert named, Henry J. McTavish, a retired vice president of the Chase Manhattan Bank and a trusted aide to David Rockefeller, was met on his first day on the job in November by a typical Moses attempt to bring him into camp. A full serving of charm and the promises of future financial rewards, if, the implication was clear, he behaved himself. Moses escorted him around the fair administration building to meet the other officers, gave him a spacious office near his own, promised him all the secretarial help he could use, and escorted him into a meeting of the fair executive committee, where it was moved that he would be appointed the fair's financial vice president on January 1st, after his study was completed. But McTavish was not a Moses man, but a Rockefeller man. A tall, tough Scotsman, he was, moreover, a hard-nosed analyst of balance sheets, who understood all too well what he found in the fairs. By standard accounting methods, he found, the fair, as of October 31, 1964, had not a surplus of $12,700,000, but a deficit of $14 million. Charm having failed, Moses essayed intimidation, summoning McTavish to a meeting at which, according to a non-Moses fair official, he hoped to make the Rockefeller man back down. In the midst of receiving estimates and projections from his department heads, Moses turned to the Scotsman and said, almost casually, this official recalls, "By the way, Mr. McTavish, do you want to say anything?" The official recalls that McTavish shifted his legs, looked Moses in the eye, and said, "Are you sure you want me to speak now?" "Certainly," Moses replied. He had no secrets from his boys. But again McTavish hesitated, asking, "Do you want me to say what I have to say before this group?" Perhaps lulled by McTavish's hesitancy into believing he had won, Moses said firmly, "I do." And then, the official recalls, McTavish let him have it. He ripped all the estimates and projections to shreds, and when he was all through, he leaned back, smiled, and said, "As of today, Mr. Moses, we're insolvent." Reality, which Moses had been attempting for months to dodge, had struck him full in the face. McTavish's secretary was fired. According to one report, she was later rehired. The executive committee voted to revoke his nomination as financial vice president, and he received a handwritten memo from Constable instructing him that, in accordance with Moses' wishes, under no circumstances was he to attend the fair employees' Christmas party. Even this ultimate prescription, however, failed to break his spirit. Moses said flatly that, under no circumstances, was he to make any copies of his formal report or to show it to anyone before Moses had approved it. But McTavish defied the order, and on December 10th sent a copy to George Moore, president of the First National City Bank and Spargo's replacement as Finance Committee chairman. Moses was frantic to keep the bad news from the press, but the bankers who had lent their names and reputations to the fair were growing worried about what would happen to their own prestige if the fair went down. This was particularly true of Moore, whose bank, unlike most of the others, had never been a leading beneficiary of past Moses bond issues. One conversation between Moore and Moses was described this way. Moore: Bob, we've found bills of 6 and 7 figures that weren't booked. We just can't continue without reliable information. Moses:
George, your figures are wrong. You don't know what you're talking about.
Moore: Bob, I've been in the banking business all my life, and if there's one thing I know, it's a column of figures. At an executive committee meeting on January 12, 1965, Moore demanded specific, audited information. Moses said to wait until next month. Moore said he couldn't continue this way. Moses accused Moore of trying to sabotage the fair.
If you don't like it, Moses shouted, you can get the hell out.
Moore did, taking a majority of the Finance Committee with him. Moreover, he did so publicly, informing reporters that he was resigning because of the way finances are being handled. You know, he said, back in June they said they would have a $50 million surplus. What has happened to that surplus?
What? I don't know.
Reporters had been writing for months that the fair was in financial difficulties. Moses had publicly branded them hyenas, jackals, yellow journalists, in effect liars, for saying so. Now the truth, that the fair was in financial difficulties far worse than any reporter had imagined, was out in the open. The meat-eaters of the media fell upon the feast with a will and tore the already bleeding carcass of the greatest single event in the history of the world to bits. Moses was flying frantically around the world, trying to round up new exhibits that would enable his fair to break previous fair's second-year fall-off pattern. And he was spectacularly successful, obtaining from the Vatican a $600,000 Gutenberg Bible, the Pope's bejeweled coronation tiara, and Michelangelo's statue of St. John, winging on to Madrid to present a fair medal to Franco and obtain new major Spanish works of art for the Spanish pavilion, arranging for a Churchill pavilion containing a film of Sir Winston's life, 30 of his paintings, and a comprehensive collection of Churchill memorabilia. Disaster was staring him in the face now. To stave it off, even Naples must be enlisted. No longer were he and Constable screening out tawdry shows and auditioning the ones allowed in to make certain that female dancers did not display belly buttons or cleavage. In 1965, there would be 9 discotheques featuring go-go dancers, and their bras were creeping further down nightly. In 1964, Moses had insisted that bras be put on Les Poupées de Paris, and that sexy posters be taken off the front doors of that show. In 1965, the girl taking tickets outside was spilling out of her bikini. To make the show's point perfectly clear, its promoter explained. Moses would not admit he had surrendered, but, as one reporter put it, everywhere there is evidence of the Moses compromise. More scantily clad girls, carnival-style booths and games, 69 new bars, Gorillas, Toto, and Gargantua too. For opening day of the second season, spectacular pageantry was arranged, a parade with 18 bands, 4,000 marchers and 31 floats, speeches by Vice President Humphrey and West German Chancellor Willy Brandt, an 8-mile run from the Central Park Arsenal to the Singer Bowl by Olympic marathon champion Abebe Bikila. Over and over, Moses repeated that 1965 would be a new fair, a new show. When he said, come to the fair now, he was almost pleading. But what the press was emphasizing now were the juicy quotes Moore was giving out, a photo of the bank president clapping his hand to his forehead in an ostentatious gesture of dismay accompanied a national magazine story on the fair, While the financial revelations from the first outside audits and Abe Beam's investigation made the financial picture look worse and worse. On January 26th, in receipt of preliminary audit figures, Moses announced that the fair would be unable to repay the city its $24 million loan, but that the $23 million in investor-held notes would be paid in full. But 2 weeks later, the final audit revealed the full extent of the gap between Moses' $12,700,000 surplus and reality, some $30 million. The fair had actually finished the first season with a deficit of $17,540,000. It was obvious to Beam's auditors that the fair was not going to be able to repay its notes in full, and the press headlined that fact. The memos waiting for Moses every morning on his desk showed the situation to be even more desperate than that. Now that the auditors had finally discovered all the unpaid bills, the fair did not have enough money to pay them. On December 31st, the exposition, which had taken in $80 million, had $639,000 in cash, unpaid bills of $3 million, and $4 million more in bills due before opening day, with no revenue expected until that day. Moses sent aides to ask the major exhibitors to prepay rents not due until after the opening, and some did. He threw into the pot $400,000 being held in escrow to guarantee his salary and ordered other aides with escrow accounts to do the same. But there was still a shortfall, and the press found out about it, and about another development in relation to it that made it a bigger story still. Not only was the fair not going to be able to reopen without a new loan, but it was having difficulty obtaining one. An executive of one of the banks approached, holder of millions of dollars worth of notes that might now become worthless, in danger of losing still more money on the fair because loans to marginal exhibitors were going bad, intimated to Fred Ferretti of the Herald Tribune that the reason his bank would not make the loan was that Moses was still in charge. The intimation was false to begin with, and Ferretti played intimation as fact with a Herald Tribune exclusive, played under the most damaging headlines yet. Loan to fair, not if Moses is kept on. And the rest of the press jumped on that story in headlines such as, Fair's Choice, Moses or Money. Even on the day the fair got the loan it needed, Newsday could, truthfully, say, Few days at the fair contain good news only. The bad news yesterday was that one of the most popular foreign buildings, the Indonesian Pavilion, is being shut down by President Sukarno because of increasing bitterness in U.S.-Indonesian relationships. Exhibitors insisted on pleading for a reduction in the admission price, at least during evening hours. When they could not obtain an audience with Moses, they went to the press. Day after day, the headlines about the fair were not about new exhibits, but about prices and deficits and money. The general aura of financial difficulties that now surrounded the fair, moreover, made it feasible for reporters to dredge up all the rumors they had been hearing for 3 years, the incredible contracts with Allied and Pinkerton and the unions, the huge salaries paid to the consultants. Beam, working with reporters and hunting for publicity, demanded the fair books so he could audit them. Moses refused to produce them, but the courts ordered him to. And as, over a period of months, Beam's auditors delved deeper and deeper into them, new facts came out. To surround the fair not only with an aura of inefficiency and financial difficulties, but with an aura of scandal, an aura linked with Moses himself. Soon Moses himself was at the center of these charges, for reporters had discovered the escrow account set up to ensure his salary. The account had been replenished by gate receipts after the fair opened for the second season. Headlines told the public that Moses had been guaranteed a salary of $100,000 per year. Actually, of course, it was $75,000 per year, plus $25,000 in expenses, plus the 7-year $27,500 per year annuity. That salary was then near incredible for a public servant. The mayor's was only $40,000 per year. There was, moreover, the escrow account. The public may not have understood it, but there was something sinister about the way the press played it. It made him seem greedy, money-hungry, taking a huge personal profit out of an institution that had been supposed to provide the city with parks and educational money, but was not doing so. The last surviving portion of the Moses image was destroyed. No one had ever said he was personally interested in money. Now they had. Of the image of Robert Moses that had stood glittering and pure for 30 years, there was now not a single part left untarnished. He became an object of derision, almost of scorn, to the reporters he had derided and scorned for so long. Every desperate move he made to try to save the fair was ridiculed. When he raised the admission price, Newsday's lead said, "Visitors to the World's Fair in 1965 will have to pay an additional 50 cents to reach peace through understanding." When he asked for an end to controversy and more expressions of confidence in the fair by Wagner, while simultaneously criticizing the mayor for withholding them in the past, Newsday's headline said, "Peacemaker Moses opens new front." The Herald Tribune had a whole stable of brilliant young columnists. At times, they almost seemed to be taking turns taking pot shots at the sitting target that the old man had become. Dick Schaap wrote a whole, hilarious column on the impossibility of reaching him on the phone, and when he visited Franco, wrote, "Moses' mission to Madrid is another indication of his keen public relations sense. Franco is practically an American folk hero. His firm democratic stance cannot be questioned. No one could be more deserving of the World's Fair's gold medal, unless, of course, it is Robert Moses himself." He tried to roar back at his critics. "Those who can, build. Those who can't, criticize," he said. But his invective, once so feared, was now ridiculed. There was a time when the verbal jousting of Robert Moses enlivened and sharpened civic controversy, said a Times editorial. In defending his handling of the World's Fair, however, Mr. Moses' sorties suffer from petulance, and what is worse, they are ineffective. He would be wise to pack in his rusty lance. When the suggestion came that he resign as president of the fair, the press was confident it would be adopted. The suggestion came from the top. Mayor Wagner was increasingly worried about the situation at the fair and afraid that its failures might tar his administration. He believed the solution was for Moses to resign and be replaced by an administrator not tied to the unsuccessful policies of the past and thus more amenable to changing them. Other officials besides the mayor were afflicted with the same worries. Between the two seasons, Governor Rockefeller and Senator Javits were also working quietly to persuade Moses to resign. For years he had been threatening to resign from one post or another, confident that no one would take him up on the threat. Now, people were asking him to resign. He would have liked to. Knowing the true financial picture, he knew that, bad as the publicity had been, it was going to get worse. And there was a more serious threat, one that was never to receive any publicity at all. Unknown to press and public, the Internal Revenue Service had begun an intensive, in-depth audit of the fair to determine if it had adhered to the restrictions that went with the various tax exemptions it had been accorded. The investigation would not be completed for months. There is some question whether it was in fact pressed to a conclusion. There was never any public report of its findings, and Moses was, years later, to write in his memoirs that it resulted in a clean bill of health. But it would have been a man supremely unconcerned about his reputation who would not be concerned about the results of such an investigation, and Moses was not such a man. He thought he saw one way to leave so that no one could say he had been forced out, to accept a call to a higher duty, a bigger job. With the United States preparing to surrender all control of the Panama Canal, there was increasing talk in Washington of building a new canal in Colombia. Moses asked Bernard Gimbel to take steps to bring him the assignment. Moses thought he could do a cheaper, higher quality job with less political pressures than anyone else, Gimbel says. Gimbel contacted New York Democratic committeeman Edwin Weissel, an intimate of President Johnson, and Weissel contacted the White House. But although no formal word was passed back, it became apparent that Moses wasn't going to get the job. "It's a sad thing," one of the Moses men would say. "Bob is old and tired. He feels he can't resign, but he can't get out any other way." And no one could make him. Wagner sent emissaries in relays, beginning with Scrivain, who made breakfast overtures. The first was discreet. "I told him that I thought he should resign because he had built this thing that everyone had said couldn't be done, and now he should let the day-to-day handling of it be done by someone else, that mere management was not a job worthy of Robert Moses." The second was more to the point. "I told Bob, 'You know damn well I'm fond of you, and I think you've done a great job, but here we are. Things aren't going well, and we're going to be deeper in the hole next year. We need a fresh start.'" The second emissary was financier John A. Coleman, Al Smith's old breakfast companion, whom Wagner selected in the hope that their shared love for the dead governor might give Coleman a unique leverage. The third was a committee of bankers, the men who had $23 million in notes and millions more in loans to individual pavilions at stake in the fair. There were further discreet hints from Rockefeller and Javits. But when Scrivain made his first suggestion, Moses said something to the effect of, "I never expected you to say a thing like that. It smacks of disloyalty." When he made his second, he started smacking the table. The words just poured out. I don't remember exactly what he said, but there was no way he was going to be forced out. With Coleman, he was friendly but firm. With the bankers, he was firm. "They're all very courageous, until they face him," Wagner says with his quiet smile. "They would be so brave. We will do this. We will tell him. And then..." It's his personality. He overawed them. Then there were attempts to force him out. "We tried every way short of going to court to get him out of there," Scrivain says. The fair board of directors or its executive committee had the power to oust him, and the members of that board, once his allies, were all falling away from him now. Additional pressure was brought. Recalls Wagner, "The banks had a big investment. I said, 'Well, you bankers, you're the ones that have to get the committee on your side.' 'Oh, we can do it, we can do it.' Well, they found out they couldn't do it." Now was the time for the dossiers. Scrivain knew what was going on. On at least 20 occasions when we were on the same side, Bob would say, "Well, God damn it, if he doesn't go along, I'll destroy the son of a bitch." And sure enough, when the vote came, the fellow would go along. Other members of the executive committee were making money from the fair concessions he had given them and didn't want to chance upsetting the arrangements. Others may have recalled that, when the fair was over, Moses would still be head of Triborough and the arterial program. They went along, too. Others supported Moses out of loyalty or conviction that he was still the best man for the job, any job. Whatever the reason, Scrivain says, we wouldn't have the votes. The same reality that the press had failed to grasp about Title I was still at work here. Not public opinion, not even the opinion of a mayor and governor, but raw power would determine whether Moses stayed on as president of the fair, and of power he still had more than enough. On the fair board were dozens of the most powerful men in the city and state. Moses handled them like unruly children. At one meeting, Senate Minority Leader Joseph Zaretsky tried to interrupt the Moses-dictated agenda by rising to a point of order. Moses smashed the gavel down. "You're out of order." "You can't do that," Zaretsky said. "I'm speaking to a point of order." Moses curtly nodded to the next scheduled speaker, Fair Executive Vice President General William Potter, who began reading his report while Zaretsky was still speaking, drowning him out because he had a microphone while Zaretsky did not. Not one member of the board raised a voice in protest. On February 24th, there were more than 75 reporters and photographers on hand for a meeting of the fair executive committee, but there were also on hand scores of nightstick-wielding Pinkertons to herd them away from the fair administration building and into the press building, where, it was announced, a briefing would be held later. At the briefing, Potter announced that the 21-member executive committee had given Moses a unanimous vote of